You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Russia's attack on Ukraine means oil prices will most likely continue to rise. We'll talk about what that means for consumers and what to expect at the pump in the future. Now, a new documentary called We the Vision tells the story of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's only newspaper by and for black students. The paper is called The Black Voice. It was created in the early 1970s and shut down after a few years. In 2015, a student decided to bring it back, and they've been reporting stories ever since. Niall Lansana is director of We the Vision. He was also co-editor-in-chief of The Black Voice in the 2020-21 school year. Niall, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, how you doing, Rob?
Good. And Alexis Yancey is an Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist. She's from Milwaukee and was a reporter for The Black Voice in the 70s. Alexis, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, let's start with you. Why was it important for you to tell the story of the black voice in this documentary?
I think that there has been such an important history and such an important legacy of journalists and excellent students that have come up through the black voice. And it is a story that is unsung and untold and uncelebrated. And as someone who came through the Black Voice, I was honored to be able to have the opportunity to tell that story in a documentary format, because the Black Voice has been amplifying Black voices and students from marginalized communities on UW-Madison's campus for generations. And it's been like super wonderful to see all of that pertinent history come together in this documentary.
Alexis, you reported for The Black Voice in its first incarnation in the 70s. Can you talk about what the creation and then working at The Black Voice meant back then?
It was exciting. Here, you know, we were given a chance to get out in the field and report outside of the classroom. And for Black students, journalism was really new to us at that time. And so we were really pioneering in the field. And so it was wonderful to be able to have a place to be able to report on issues that were affecting us on campus, as well as what was going on campus and at other Black colleges and in Black communities across the nation.
Niall, an important part of the story for you is why the Black Voice was needed, you say, then and now. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. The Black Voice was needed then because there was no space for Black students to share their stories on campus. And coming out of the 1969 Black student strike, those students like Alexis saw how necessary it was to be able to express themselves freely and make sure that they're lifting each other's voices up as a means of like being able to go through the day-to-day struggles of being a Black student on UW-Madison's campus. And like, I think it was wild to see in going through the university archives and reading some of the first iterations of the Black Voice, how the issues that they were going through in the 70s is a lot of the same stuff that we're talking about now, but also like just like they had poems back then. Like myself, I'm a poet, being able to see how they express joy and they express and how they built community through journalism is the exact same way that I was able to do it when I was coming through the Black Voice. And I think the documentary We the Vision does a beautiful job of exemplifying that.
Alexis, you went on to a career in journalism, as I mentioned. How did your time with the Black Voice as a student influence you as a journalist?
It was a tremendous influence. Especially under the direction of Assistant Professor Pam Johnson, the first Black professor that I had in Madison and the first Black woman to teach, male or female, I believe, in the J School at the University of Wisconsin. And so being able to report for the Black Voice, and also I reported the news segment on Blackness Radio, and that actually spurred my career into television journalism. And so it was very influential for me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, how, you know, getting clips in the paper, getting that broadcast experience. did it help open up professional opportunities for you? Because I think a lot of times you apply for a journalism job, they want to see your clips.
Exactly. And basically at that time, what you had was what we did for the Black Voice, what I did for Blackness, and what I did for my classes. And eventually in my senior year, I was actually able to do some couple of reports for one of the television stations in Madison. But I couldn't have gotten there without the experience that I had at the Black Voice and Blackness.
Niall, Alexis mentioned earlier that a career in journalism, the door didn't necessarily look open to Black students in the 70s. There are still reports that Black reporters are underrepresented in the media. Are you hoping the new incarnation of the Black Voice could be part of solving that?
Absolutely. I think that the quality has never lacked with Black journalists. It's about the opportunities. It's about the doors being open. And we've been banging on the door for decades, and we're going to continue to bang on the door because our stories are worthy of being told. And we are excellent at telling those stories and making those connections. Like, some of the students that have come through the Black Voice have interned at Essence Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, like some of the best publications in the country. And that's not going to change. And all of that work is coming from the Black Voice. All of those students are coming through the Black Voice. And it has been such an empowering resource and platform for myself, and I know for many other of the students who come through.
Alexis, as we wrap up, what does it mean for you to, you know, to have done this in the 70s and then a new generation picks up the torch years later?
It's really great to see. I myself, as one of those people who rose to the ranks of being a network news producer at CBS News, it is inspiring because we have paved the way for others to come behind us. And that's what we wanted to do. And we have thousands in media right now, but at now there's more thousands, more media outlets, but it's still, we still aren't represented fully in each of those organizations. And so it's very important for us to continue the legacy and for us to mentor more journalists coming into the field who are African-American.
Alexis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Niall, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, absolutely.
That was Alexis Yancey and Niall Lansana, two alums of UW-Madison's newspaper buy-in for Black students called The Black Voice. They're with us today to talk about the story of the paper and a new documentary about it called We the Vision. It's playing at the Marquee Theater at UW-Madison tomorrow evening at 6. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about Wisconsin comedian and now best-selling author Charlie Behrens.
Comedian and host of the Manitowoc Minute, Charlie Behrens, is at it again, this time with his book landing on the New York Times bestsellers list. Beta host Doug Gordon recently caught up with Charlie, where he asks him about the difference between the Manitowoc Minute guy and the real Charlie Behrens.
Well, the Manitowoc Minute version is basically just an exaggerated version of who I am. And it, you know, is based off my time in local news where people would say I did things wrong, I said things wrong, I had an accent. Bubbler is not a word you can say in Texas, and it means the same thing in Wisconsin. And so the Manitowoc Minute version is a parody of the newsman that I was, where I doubled down on all the things people said I was doing wrong. Whereas, you know, in this book, I'm kind of coming to it more from who I really am. There's a lot of stories there growing up and everything, but the heart of both the Manitowoc Minute character and kind of who I am is the same. It's that same sort of Midwest mentality, that kind of be nice first, ask questions later.
How can I help you?
I'll just get whatever's easiest for you guys. It'll be good.
You just look at the menu and pick whatever you want.
No, I insist, whatever's easiest.
Well, spicy food is pretty quick and easy. Can you do spicy?
Yeah, I can do spicy. Yeah.
Are you sure? Cajun spicy. Looks down scattered. South Mississippi.
I've been down south. I've been to Cudahy. So.
Can you identify a turning point along your journey where you realized that your Manitowoc Minute was going to become your very own media empire?
Oh, no. I was doing stand up because I wasn't thrilled with my job at the time. And I did this character, which would become the Manitowoc Minute character in the comedy clubs. And I remember this one show in particular at the Comedy Store. And I said, is anybody from the Midwest? And then you see in this Los Angeles comedy club, like a quarter of the room, maybe more, had their hands up. And so, you know, and that bit always did well. No matter how much my other stand-up bombed, that would always help me recover. So I was like, oh, there's something here. So I made this video, the first video, the Manitowoc Minute.
Okay, welcome to the Manitowoc Minute. This week's episode sponsored by Bobberdown Bait Shop up there in Plover. Plover, of course, is right off 39, right before you get to Stevens Point. If you get to Stevens Point, pointer back the other way. Let's get these headlines done real quick once.
And it was, I named it after a fella in that club who was talking to me. He's from Manitowoc. So I didn't think I'd do a second one. And then that first one took off. You know, I think it got 500,000 views.
Why does Midwest life resonate with the rest of the country?
Well, you know, I think that it's one of those areas, a lot of people from other parts of the country view it as sort of the flyover states. And I think it's been largely ignored in pop culture, or it's been viewed as just kind of bland or somewhere in the middle, you know? But I think as we've kind of explored it, and there are a lot of comedians now sort of exploring the Midwest, we see these staples of our culture that you don't often think of. Once you shine a little flashlight on them, they're like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Since our show Beta airs on Wisconsin Public Radio, we always have to be careful about the kind of language that we use. Could you give us some Midwest alternatives to cuss words that we could use for when the proverbial guano hits the fan?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can say anything. Cripes is a staple. You know, and my grandpa Bob taught me that, you know, he didn't want to take the Lord's name in vain, so he would always say, cripes almighty.
Seasoned rice. Criminy. Fudge. So you get a 1/4 inch bit and, son of a bitch. I mean, jeepers cripes. Get grandpa a beer, will ya?
Charlie Barron's book is called The Midwest Survival Guide, How We Talk, Love, Work, Drink, and Eat Everything with Ranch. You can hear the full conversation on WPR's Beta. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we find out what the Russian invasion of Ukraine means for oil prices. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Oil prices are expected to rise amid the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Energy prices were already high. The cost of a gallon of regular gas in Wisconsin is around $3.35. A year ago, that number was around $2.60. What's next? Jim Ritterbusch is the president of Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm in Galena, Illinois. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
How does the Russian invasion of Ukraine affect the balance of the world's oil markets?
Well, it's not a one-way street. The widespread assumption is that it'll keep pushing oil prices higher. But we've been leading up to this thing for a couple of weeks, and from exactly 2 weeks ago, WTI, which is the U.S. crude benchmark, has only been up about $2 per barrel. So thus far, we've had a subdued response to this thing. Today, we had a price spike of about $4 or so, but we have so many cross currents in here of a military and economic and a political nature that this market, I think, is just going to ratchet higher rather than just shoot up in a straight line.
I might have expected it to go up faster. Russia is a pretty big supplier of oil and natural gas. Can you talk about Russian production and where it fits into the global oil scene?
Sure. Russia is about the third largest producer. They may not be there for long, but they produce around 10 million barrels a day, and they export about 7.5 million barrels per day. So it They've been a reliable supplier to the global market, but I think that's just about to change.
Yeah, we haven't seen, as and correct if I'm wrong on this, we haven't seen a full-on sanction stopping the flow of oil from Russia to other countries. If that were to happen, do you think it would put more pressure on oil prices?
Absolutely. That's the that's the big item in this whole thing. If there's any clampdown on Russian exports, if there's a sanction against movement out of Russia regarding their Urals crude grade, then we're going to spike. Then we're going to see gasoline in your area significantly above that $4 a gallon mark. However, having said that, that's a decision that would have adverse impacts across most spaces. So here in the United States, should there be a decision to clamp down on Russian exports, then you're going to see inflation push harder and higher. In the near term, I think we'll probably waffle around, gradually edge higher, and then it all depends. And you just laid out the key point here, and that regards the possibility of a sanction on Russian crude exports.
Talking to oil trading advisory firm President Jim Ritterbusch about oil prices during the Russia-Ukraine crisis. Jim, before this, now it wasn't that long ago that I was talking to you about oil prices being so low. One benchmark actually, I think, dipped negative briefly. Like, we'll pay you to take this off our hands, in effect, so we don't have to store it. How do we go from there? That was early pandemic to here, where we already had fairly high oil prices again.
Yeah, Rob, that was almost a couple of years ago, and that was the WTI crude grade that dipped into negative territory, which was certainly a unique event that we'll never see again. But going forward from that point, we've had production that's never really fully recovered for several reasons. At the same time, demand has recovered considerably as COVID and the Omicron have ramped down, and more people getting out and using the cars and consuming gasoline and heating up their homes. So we've had that huge recovery. So the demand side of that equation is very easy to explain. However, the supply side is a bit more complicated. The big oil producers have never really produced anywhere close to what they were doing before the pandemic, which was around 13 million barrels a day or so.
Yeah, what's going on there? Because you think prices are high, so Saudi Arabia might up production. Marginal producers here in the U.S. might swing back into action. Why hasn't that been happening?
Well, you're talking about economics 101 there, Rob, and that hasn't necessarily applied. Within the United States, the big oil companies, the names that you'd immediately recognize, have shifted their whole strategy. They've been burnt so many times by producing too much and watching the price fall that the past couple of years they've exercised a tremendous amount of restraint. And what they've opted to do is what I call emphasize value over growth. So in this kind of growing production, they're emphasizing value by returning money to their shareholders, and that's taken two forms. One, they bought back shares, and secondly, they've tossed out some pretty attractive dividends. So, crude production in the U.S. has recovered about 11.6 million barrels, and again, that compares with 13 million before the pandemic. So we've got a ways to go before we get there, and these U.S. producers aren't showing any inclination as far as trading or changing their strategy. Now, on the Saudi side, they're within this organization called OPEC Plus, and they've had a mandate to gradually feed extra oil back into the market at a pace of about 400,000 barrels per day. The bad news is that just hasn't been enough to keep pace with this strong demand that we've seen.
Jim, I'm seeing some of the big name companies you mentioned are cutting their ties with Gazprom, the Russian. I think this is mostly a story about natural gas production. Is something comparable happening with oil production, where we're seeing national, international companies get out of partnerships with Russian companies? If so, is that meaningful?
It's meaningful at the margin. Thus far, it's not going to make a lot of difference. These have been primarily European countries, such as companies such as Shell and BP, I believe, pulled out of Russia here today. But on a broader scale, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference. And I think the big difference will be of an economic nature. I think this Russian economy is just going to get beaten down so bad by the sanctions and by the adversity surrounding this whole mess that could prompt a decision to pull back out of Ukraine. But just today, the Russian ruble, the currency, was driven down to new lows. I think it's been down maybe 50% in less than a week. The Russian stock market didn't open today, and I'm being told it won't open tomorrow. But ETFs that replicate the Russian stock market are off, I believe, 27% just today. So this is going to enact a tremendous amount of pain on Russia, and there's nothing like economics to bring somebody to the bargaining table to have a serious discussion.
And Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jim Ritterbusch, president of Ritterbusch & Associates, looking at oil prices during Russia's attack on Ukraine. Tomorrow on Central Time, a new project in Wisconsin tackles loneliness, that and more, tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editor tells us about a new project he's working on to highlight Wisconsinites who are weaving social fabric back together in their communities. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Russia's attacks on Ukraine continue. We'll look at the global response and where things could go from here. First, who are the people, the individuals, the Wisconsinites who are working to fix what's broken in our society? A new project from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is answering that question in a series of pieces about people they're calling weavers. It's inspired by an initiative by the Aspen Institute to recognize and support people around the country building connections in their communities, effectively weaving social trust back together. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who's bringing people together in your community? How would you rate the level of trust you have in your neighborhood, in your city? If it's high, why is that? If it's low, how come? What do you think needs to be done to raise trust, to bring communities in Wisconsin back together amidst a big partisan divide? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David Haynes is the Ideas Lab editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His piece introducing this project for the newspaper came out earlier this month. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be with you.
Can you talk a little more about the inspiration behind this Wisconsin Weavers project?
Well, sure. I was at a speech by David Brooks at the La Follette School at the UW back in October. And, you know, he has spent the last several years going around the country and talking to people. And he was left with this feeling that people are feeling sort of ignored in some cases, not heard. He was struck by the amount of social isolation he was seeing. And so back in 2018 with the Aspen Institute, he founded what is called the Weave Project. And I was really struck by the...
I'm going to jump in. I'm going to jump in, David. We have kind of a weird thing going on with the connection here. Our board operator will talk to you now. Talking to David Haynes about this new project through the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel called the Wisconsin Weaver Project. You may have heard conversations like this on this show where somebody sees a problem in their community and does something to try to fix it. If you have done something like that, or you know someone who has, want to recognize them, you can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, we've got that connection, resolved now. So you were talking about, you'd heard that speech by David Brooks. The Aspen Institute's been doing this Weaver Project. What kind of things are you looking for in this project?
Well, thanks, Rob, and sorry for the interference there. So we know that in every community in Wisconsin, every city, village, and town, there are people who are doing great work to bring other people together, often across difference. And we just want to tell some of those stories. I think we're in a period where there's so much political polarization. There's so much in the news. If you listen to the radio, if you read the newspaper, it doesn't seem like anyone's talking to anyone. But in fact, in every community, there are people just doing really good work and often under the radar and often underappreciated. Brooks talks about people who show up all the way, And these are people who, when you go into a community and ask who's trusted in that community, everyone seems to know them. And so I think about somebody, and I'll just give a quick example. Sure. In Milwaukee. There's a young muralist, her name is Tia Richardson. And when she does a mural, she gets together with the community, the neighborhood, and they talk about what that should be like. What do you want to see in the art that I'm going to create? And then when she creates the art on the side of a building or wherever, she often brings the neighborhood together and they paint it together. And there's often food and beverage. And so, you know, it's a community project. It brings people together. She's a weaver. There's a Southside coffee shop that's attached to a Spanish language school, part of Milwaukee Public Schools. They've opened a coffee shop where the kids can learn how to be baristas. These are middle school and high school kids. But they've also opened it up now to the community where people can come in and do book readings, or you have a guitarist maybe on Thursday nights. That's weaving. And so we want to tell some of those stories.
I think it can be easy to look at all the problems of a community, of a state, of a world, and think there's nothing I, one individual, can do to tackle that. And it seems like you're focusing on the people who don't let that stop them.
That's right. And I think what Brooks found is that there are lots of people who, when they see something that needs to be done, they do it. They do it without being asked. They don't expect anything in return. They just help out. You know, it might be somebody in a neighborhood who just checks on all the older people in the neighborhood to make sure they're okay. There's a woman in Minneapolis, and her name's escaping me now, but a few years ago, she started inviting people she didn't know into her home for dinner. And one of the dinners that people always talk about is she had a group of people in, including someone who was homeless. And she asked the question, what does it mean to have a home? And that led to this really rich discussion. She's a great cook, so she made dinner for everyone. Well, that became kind of a program now that's been used by a number of institutions in Minneapolis, including the Minneapolis Police Department, to help bring people together. And so I think there are people like that all over Wisconsin that we can focus on.
Talking to David Haynes, the Ideas Lab editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a new project there called the Wisconsin Weaver Project, looking to highlight the work, often unsung work, of people in communities around the state to bring people together in one way or another, to get past divides, to transcend divisions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about this, the kind of things they're looking for, or if you have an example to share in your own community, something big, something small. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And David, you are looking for nominations, right, for people to be featured in the Wisconsin Weaver Project?
We sure are. And we have a forum that we've created that's embedded in a story that I did just a couple weeks ago announcing the project. And people can find that at jsonline.com/ideas-lab. That's jsonline.com/ideas-lab. And that story's free. Anybody can look at it. There's a form embedded in the bottom, and fill it out and send it to us. We'd love to hear from you. Or you can just email me at david.haynes@jrn.com.
I want to look at a couple of the other what people you mentioned in that piece. You mentioned this is not just Milwaukee. An Appleton woman on the theme of addiction. Can you talk about her work there?
Yeah. So she went through, and we have a reporter who's just digging into this, and that story will be published in a couple of 3 weeks. But she suffered what is probably the worst thing can ever happen to a parent. She lost a daughter to an addiction. But since then, she's turned that pain and trauma into helping others who are going through similar situations. And she's become quite well known in the Appleton area for the work she's doing. Another piece that I'm actually working on out of La Crosse is a story that Wisconsin Public Radio actually did a year or two ago on a group there that that calls itself Waking Up White. It's a group of white people in the community who worked with an African-American man from UW-La Crosse as their guide to understand racism, to sort of take responsibility for their role in racism in the community. And you know what they've done? They've created what I would call an ecosystem of care around racism in that community. So they have infrastructure now for when there's an incident or when something's going on that needs to be talked about. They've done a lot of group meetings. They've got the top people in the community involved. They've done videos that you can watch. They've got into the schools. It's really quite an impressive program. And again, that's weaving. That's bringing people together across difference.
David, I got to say, I really like this. When I look back at my career in public radio, such as it is, the ones I remember, you know, when people ask me what are my favorite interviews, it's this kind of thing. I think back a guy in Milwaukee who started up a community garden project for mostly teen guys there, or a Delafield pastor who started a Boys and Girls Club in that community. Public art projects in Green Bay and Fox Cities that brought community members back together as a broadcaster, as a journalist. That's the kind of thing that gives me the most satisfaction. It feels like I'm doing something important. Are you thinking that way after a fairly long career in journalism yourself?
I am, and I agree with you. And we just hope that by highlighting and lifting up some of the people who we know across every community in the state are doing good work, that we can encourage a few more people, maybe nudge them just a little to think when something needs to be done, they'll step up and do it. I think a lot of people do that anyway, but we would love to be able to do that. You know, you mentioned the stories that you've covered. I think of one. There's a woman and her son on Buffum Street in Milwaukee in an area of town that unfortunately has been really plagued by a lot of violence in recent years. But on her block, not so much. She and her son have kind of taken charge of the block. They have a block party every year. They give away backpacks filled with school supplies for the kids in the neighborhood. There was a chop shop down the street. They got it shut down. There was a drug house on the block. They got it shut down by persistence. And it's people like that who really care and step up that I think it's rewarding for us to cover, but it's inspiring for us to see.
We're talking to David Haynes, Ideas Lab editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about a project the paper started telling stories about Wisconsinites who are weaving social fabric back together in their communities. People, as he said, who step up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does that call to mind somebody in your community, at your workplace, in your congregation, whatever it might be, someone who saw a problem and worked to fix it in the community, saw an opportunity, worked to bring people together to seize that opportunity? In tough times, do you like to hear stories like this? Do you want to see newspapers cover this kind of thing and radio stations cover this kind of thing more than maybe we do right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about people who are rebuilding social connections in their communities. Our guest is David Haynes, Ideas Lab editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The paper started a new project highlighting the stories of some of these Wisconsin weavers, they're calling them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a story to share? Somebody you'd like to highlight in your own community? Somebody who saw a need and helped to meet it, you could join in right now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, the problem you're trying to solve here, you were starting to touch on that earlier. You wrote in that inaugural piece there about some of the loneliness, some of the detachment that seems to be coming along with our partisan and other divides.
Yeah, when I heard David Brooks speak in Madison back in October at the La Follette School, it really struck me some of the things he was talking about. He spent, as I mentioned earlier, about 3 years prior to establishing the Weave Project, just going around the country and talking to people in the wake of the 2016 election. And we all know that that was a very polarizing election with a lot of vitriol on both sides. And what he found was that large groups of people in the country felt left out. They felt unheard. There was a lot of social disconnection. It's become very easy to write people off. And the result is it's also become very easy to be sort of mean-spirited. We see that a lot, unfortunately, on social media feeds. I personally think it's very harmful. And the question is, what do you do about it? And I think that he decided, along with Aspen, and we've decided as well, that we just need to find people who are running counter to that and write about them and lift them up a little bit. Brooks talks about, and I agree with him, if you live in the media world, as you and I do, it's easy to get a little depressed because the news is often not so good and people are not so nice to one another. But actually, outside of that bubble, there are a lot of good things going on. So we just want to try to find a few of them.
Where should people look in their own communities to find these stories? Because I think it's easy to live in a place and see a problem and bemoan it, complain about it. I'm really good at doing that just in my daily life. How do we open our eyes and see the people doing this work?
Yeah, it's a really good question. What Brooks said, and I think this is really true, and I found it to be true as well, is they would go into communities and they would just start talking to people and they would ask the question, who's trusted? Who's trusted in your neighborhood? Who's trusted in your community? And after a while, they begin to hear the same names. So I think people know who's doing the good work. I think of, I'll give you another example that, I don't know if we'll write about this one, but I think it's an example of a weaver. There's a food pantry in the east side of Milwaukee that attracts a lot of people from the suburbs to come in and do good work, you know, hand out food, work with people who are poor. But it's not just about handing out the food. They train people about what poverty is and who's impoverished and how that's changing in our city. And how many people are impoverished and what it means to be impoverished, how your life changes. So you go through a little bit of training and then you're encouraged to sit down at a table with someone who's a client and meet them, to learn their name and to get to know them. And so it becomes a human connection. So it's not just about passing out food, it's about weaving. And so I think that you ask, how do you find them? I think they're all over the place. Once you begin to look, you see a lot of people doing this kind of work.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sherry is with us in Madison. Sherry, hi.
Hi. Yeah.
What'd you want to tell us about, Sherry?
I just wanted to share my experience about how much difference positive news can make. I used to live in a small town in Idaho called Wendell, and it was a town of 2,000. And it was really kind of a dying town, and most of the storefronts were empty. We only had really like two businesses left in town. And people were very concerned that the town was going to close down. there was also like drug trafficking and other problems going on, and that was what was being reported. And I began reporting for the newspaper, and I began reporting on good things that were happening and good things people were doing, and on each business that opened up, and beginning to show people that there were people who were making good steps in our town. And as I continued to do this, within a year, a big change had come. Hmm. And by the end of 2 years, every storefront was full, and they were having to build new buildings to hold the new businesses.
Fantastic, Sherry. Thanks so much for sharing that. David, we hear about the broken windows theory where one bad thing can snowball into others. Sounds like Sherry had a reverse of that, the opposite of that. Highlight good things and other good things can follow.
Oh, Sherry, I love that story. That's just a wonderful story. And I think it's true. You know, we're really good at, and we need to be as journalists, at exposing what's wrong and highlighting when things aren't going well. But there are other stories we should do as well. We should look at solutions. What are the ways to solve the problem, evidence-based ways to solve the problems that we have? But we also should focus on people who are just doing the good work, right? And as Sherry did. Great story.
Thanks, Sherry. We'll go next to Madison in Westby. Madison, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us, Madison?
So I wanted to talk a little bit about my mother, actually. Her name is Lisa. And she is this incredible woman who I hope to grow up half as cool. So she actually started a haunted house in the community. We host that in Viroqua, the next town over. And instead of taking the profits for, you know, ourselves or herself, we actually go to a different charity every year and give the profits to the charities in the area so we can help out our local community financially. This year, we're actually going to do a little different pricing with it because we usually only charge $5 entry fee. This year, we're going to charge $7 or $5 with a canned good so that we can donate those canned goods to our local pantries, as well as financially benefiting one of the historical societies in our community, because they actually get down and dirty and go into schools and uncover a lot of the historical truths that have been kind of hidden and lost to time. And they are very involved in holding up heritage and, you know, teaching the younger generation about how the town came to be. And
Madison, we're just about out of time, but thank you so much for sharing that story, David. And I often think, like, any cool community event like Madison and Madison's mom's haunted house, anything cool, a park, whatever, in a community that I enjoy, somebody like them started at some point.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome story. And Madison, if you wouldn't mind, go to jsonline.com/ideas-lab, click on the top story and fill out the form at the end, and enter your mom, please. Thank you.
Thanks so much for sharing that story, Madison. I appreciate it. David, I mean, I feel like I hear you as you just share some of the stories. It sounds like you're encouraged and inspired just by encountering these stories.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you really are. It's easy in our business, as you know, to feel like feel a little negative sometimes, because we have to report on some difficult stories. But it's good to be reminded that there are people doing great things out there, and we need to tell some of those stories.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
David Haynes is the Ideas Lab editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him today about a new project he's working on that highlights people in Wisconsin who are doing stuff. Stuff that helps weave social fabric back together in their communities. If there's someone in your community who you think deserves some recognition as one of these weavers in Wisconsin, you can email our guest at david.haynes@jrn.com or visit the website he mentioned and nominate someone, jsonline.com/ideas-lab. Again, that's jsonline.com/ideas-lab. Coming up after the news, we dive into the latest coming out of Ukraine, including an effort at peace talks and a growing list of countries joining various sanctions against Russia. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.